Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
There are 40,000 victims of modern slavery on any one day in Australia, as reported by the Australian Federal Police. That's shocking, right? Well, my guest on this episode is Sally Irwin, founder and MD of the Freedom Hub, who are committed to create a world of freedom by ending modern slavery. Sally has a career background in the corporate sector, but in 2008, she moved to Germany when her husband took up a diplomatic post in Berlin. There, Sally was confronted with the issue of human trafficking in Eastern Europe and established a charity in Berlin to fund organizations that supported the victims. She became very active in a center supporting women trafficked in prostitution. After 4 years working face-to-face with trauma victims of modern slavery, Sally returned to Sydney in 2012, keen to apply her experience in Australia. She found a gap in Australia's care for slavery victims, resulting in the creation of the Freedom Hub. In March 2014, Sally founded the Freedom Hub Survivor School that rebuilds the lives of slavery victims and is the only specialised long-term support in Australia. The Freedom Hub trauma-informed classes train, equip, and provide work experience to survivors of modern slavery in Australia. With over 14 years of frontline experience, the Freedom Hub is now a leading organisation in this field. Sally is such an inspiring leader committed to creating change. She shares in this interview her extraordinary story that saw her move from a corporate career to being posted overseas as a diplomatic's wife to starting the Freedom Hub. She describes the problem the Freedom Hub is tackling, not just that modern slavery exists, but that there is no long-term care for victims of modern slavery in Australia. This is an episode you don't want to miss. I absolutely love Sally's commitment to tackling this problem and how it has led her to create an innovative organisational model that creates value for a range of different stakeholders. Her story and that of the Freedom Hub is utterly compelling and will, I have no doubt, inspire you. Sally, welcome to the For Love and Money podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm very excited to be on this podcast. Thanks for inviting me.
Wonderful. I'm really looking forward to our conversation and helping our listeners understand the problem of modern slavery and what you're doing with your organization, the Freedom Hub, to tackle it. But let's start with the question I ask all of my guests, which is thinking about business, thinking about purpose in business. Does love have a role to play? What are your thoughts?
I think it seriously does. I never did as a corporate high flyer in the 80s and 90s. I think today especially, but really for me, as I have not just matured, but seen the state of the world with all my travels, I have always had this thing in my heart where I'm like, we've got to be able to make business have purpose, which I know we're going to talk a lot more about. But with that is the heart change that has to come, that you're not about profit. It's the heart that of loving others that comes for actually doing good with what your work so that it impacts and helps people more vulnerable than yourselves. And the blessed and amazing place we live in Australia, you know, you've got to be able to express that. I think that gets you out of bed in the morning, to be honest, or gets me out of bed in the morning. I think with your staff, particularly since COVID, we've become a very empathetic community. We've all realised that we're all having stressful, difficult days. So I think we have to be a lot more caring and loving in the work environment. And people, you know, today we've found out fear doesn't drive people like it. Maybe that's how the corporate world was for me. But it is actually loving and encouragement. And in fact, that's one of our key values at the Freedom Hub is encouragement. We start every meeting by encouraging each other. So I think there's a lot, people thrive in a loving or caring environment anyway. And I think customers, that then reflects through to the business world, your customers, they can see it. They can see that you're putting people first, you're putting them ahead. There are difficult times where you have to make decisions that put people first when you just sit there going, oh my gosh, I'd really enjoy that profit or that money right now, but we're a people first organization. And so I think there's loads of room for love in the business world today. Yes.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And I really love that one of your values is encouragement, because it goes to this idea that, you know, people are capable of so much.
Yes.
And yep. When you support them and encourage them and lift them up rather than berate them and why aren't you doing this, like we can all get so much more from that approach.
Yes, yes. It's and it's not necessarily instinctive, particularly when we live in such a critical world, and our environment around us is. So I'm sure my team roll their eyes, but we start every meeting with encouragement. Who did you encourage last week, and how have you felt encouraged? Every single meeting with our key team. That's essential. And then, you know, there's just little things that I try and build into myself to keep myself on track. And then I try, because I'm a talker, you'll notice that. I love to talk. So I really try very hard to make sure my first one or two questions, or when I see someone, when I come into the office, is about them, how their weekend's been or how their life is or whatever. Before I talk about myself or anything task, I always try and do that as well. So I just think that builds the I care about you into, because I do, it's so easy in the office particularly to run in and go, oh my gosh, the traffic's been
shit. Oh yeah.
Or, you know, you just start on such a negative note.
Yeah.
So it's really, really a loving thing to do, to find out how they are going and what they're doing and how they're traveling for the day.
I love the intention you have behind that intentionality. Okay, let's give our listeners some context. So what is Freedom Hub?
So the Freedom Hub is a survivor school that actually helps victims of modern day slavery recover from the trauma that they've been through. But this is people who have been victims in Australia, of which the stats are around, the official stats are 40,000. We know that only one in five come forward. I'm sure there's more than that.
Well, wait, 40,000
people,
victims of slavery, modern slavery in Australia.
Yes, and those stats are about 3 years old. So, and they were taken during a time of COVID when there wasn't a lot of access to information. I think there's a lot more. But that's the official figure done by Walk Free and International IOM.
So can I ask, is that estimated or is that reported victims?
Estimated. That's them working through the research that they have and the Department of Criminology and Australian Federal Police. They believe that there's 40,000 people in slavery on any one day in Australia.
That is unbelievable. Yes. And where... Can you talk to that problem a little bit more? Sorry, I interrupted you as you were about
right,
to, I think.
That's all right. That is our key purpose, is to help them. I came back from Europe and was very angry, and I can tell the whole story soon, but I was just really mad that this could happen in our country. Like, I've always been of the mindset that it's in countries with poverty and people are trying to escape poverty, but here it's pure greed and people are literally being tricked and lied to and forced into slavery. And many of them are from cultures where slavery is common. So they think, well, Australia's just like everywhere else in the world. And so that's how they end up so easily tricked. Or they don't understand that we have human rights, that we have fair work, that we have superannuation, that we have laws. This is not exploitation we're talking about. This is slavery. This is zero money and control of their freedom. So they can't leave. So you might say, yes, I am going to accept a job for $5 an hour, 7-Eleven, for example. You might say that, but you can walk out that door at any time. That's not slavery. If you can't walk out that door because your life's at threat, you've got some kind of threat over your family or your beliefs, being told that you may get thrown into jail if anyone finds you here, or you've got no visa anymore because I've got control of it, or, you know, there's manipulative control that the fear is that they believe they can't leave the situation. So, or there's physical abuse. You know, there is still some locking up of people, but it tends to be more in the mind. The control's very real to them. So it is a real problem. And I was just so mad that this could happen in our country, the lucky country. It's just not right. So that's why the Freedom Hub started, and I started the Survivor School, because it took me quite a while, a bit of research, to find out that there was At the time in 2012, when I was making the decision to do this, there was no long-term care in Australia for victims of slavery. And I believe today we're still the only long-term care that specialises in helping people with modern-day slavery. There is long-term care for people that maybe are coming out of prostitution or, you know, different areas of slavery, and they're with other organisations that don't specialise, but we specialise. So we have really worked hard at making sure that we do everything through a trauma-informed, victim-centred or survivor-centred system. Unfortunately, our country is still criminal focused. When they if they are found by the federal police, they have to make a decision within 60 to 90 days with the Red Cross, who the AFP give them to manage their case. They have to make a decision that they're going to stay and prosecute. Otherwise, they're sent home to their country, which is their greatest fear. Wow. Which is their greatest fear? Is it their greatest fear that they've got to go back to the poverty or whatever it was that they escaped with all the shame of failing? And sometimes they've had old villages fundraise and help them get here to study in our country or to work. Is that their greatest fear? Or is the greatest fear that they've got to face this perpetrator that they've finally just escaped for the first time in years?
Oh, that's awful.
It's a hideous situation that they are thrown into. So at the Freedom Hub, we try and either help them navigate through that if they've come through the criminal justice system. But if they've come directly to us, we will actually try and protect them from those decisions until they feel safe, until they feel secure, and that they're ready to sort of get on with life and get a job and actually settle in Australia, and then we'll help them through the criminal justice process of prosecuting the perpetrator. Yeah.
That's incredible. And I mean, you talk about the scale of the problem, 40,000 survivors, victims of modern slavery, and yet your organisation, as far as you know, is the only one that looks at long-term care.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, which is why we're needed and why we're trying to scale so quickly, especially nationally, because it's not just in Sydney and Brisbane, which is our two main hubs at the moment. We've got a waiting list in Melbourne, and there's quite a demand for us in Perth right now. But no one will fund a volunteer organisation, so I need to. We're working really hard to try and establish the funding to get the other states set up. In the pre-COVID, we would have to fly them to Sydney, which was a huge expense.
Yeah, of course.
But since COVID, we have managed to get a lot of our curriculum online, and we can, as we are in Melbourne, working through some courses and trying to meet with them regularly online. And in Sydney, we do that if people aren't feeling well or they've had triggers or traumas during the night. But we're trying to get back to fully face-to-face as quickly as possible because, well, we know that interaction with people, everybody heals when they're interacting in community and interacting with people face-to-face. So, and, you know, neuroplasticity in the brain shows and demonstrates that. Research shows that people's healing happens faster if they're talking and communicating with people, especially people that have been in their own situation. So the more we can get face-to-face work, the better, working with trauma. Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, we're going to come back to the Freedom Hub and what you do, and I do want to get into the nitty-gritty of it. But before that, can you share your background story, you know, that brought you to starting the Freedom Hub in the first place?
Yes, it's one of the big questions I always get asked, because people look at me and go, how did you end up in this dark?
And how did you discover the problem? And take us through it.
Yeah. I actually discovered the problem was real through my daughter, who was a young leader in year 11 at school and got selected to do a World Vision Leadership conference or something out at the Sydney Stadium. There were kids from each school all over Australia, and they were learning about, particularly in India, the caste system, and they were learning about child labour. And they had a real experience, which you'd never get away with today, but they were actually put in a dark room and made to put matches in boxes. It might have been, it felt like an hour to them. It was probably only a few minutes, but it was an example for them of what it was like to have to work in a factory. And they had to debrief that. And it was life-changing for my daughter. I remember, you know, at 15, it wouldn't have been year 11. It might have been early year 11 for her, because we moved to Berlin, Germany in year 11. Anyway, she came home in tears because she actually thought William Wilberforce ended slavery. And she just couldn't believe it was happening in the world. So like every parent, I think, when our kids take an interest in a topic, you want to help them with that, right? So I started scrapbooking, and it's like when you decide you're going to buy a blue mini. From then on, you can see blue minis everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly, I could see this in the papers. Suddenly it was like, because back then it was all papers, but I was suddenly seeing all the news stories about people being found in slavery. And so all overseas though. And so I started almost like scrapbooking. Every time I found something, I'd either cut it out or print it for her and send it to her to keep her. And she ended up majoring in this subject for year 12. But in the meantime, we'd discovered it was happening in Europe, and we knew we were being posted to Europe with my husband's work as a diplomat. He was posted to the Australian Embassy in Berlin. I got there thinking, well, this is going to be a nice little fun break in life. I'll be drinking champagne every night, doing cocktail parties every night. This will be lovely. And it was for about 3 or 4 months. And then I'm like, I can't do this for 4 years. Like I call it cocktail German. All I could do is talk about the weather, my children, where I'm from, Australia, and in German. And then I'd have to move to the next cocktail table conversation over again because I couldn't get the language. And also being diplomats was a high level of, it was political language. It wasn't just your everyday. And so I just realized very quickly that cocktail parties are fun every night of the week, but it's not going to do my brain any good. And so I thought I would start looking for something to do. And in the meantime, my daughter, who's now majoring in human rights or wanting to be, she's decided that's going to be her career. She wanted to do human rights law, which she has now done and done her master's and has now joined me at the Freedom Hub.
But that's amazing.
I know. But back then it was still a dream for her. And I thought, oh, maybe I could get involved somehow. And then I literally found that there was this like a soup kitchen, needle exchange, whatever, on one of the streets where the prostitutes, the girls have been sex trafficked out of Romania and Belgium and Poland and all the Eastern, Old East into Berlin, thinking they were going to be hairdressers or working in a restaurant or, you know, they thought they were coming for good jobs, tricked by women in employment agencies in their country.
Wow.
I know. So that's where it all started. I thought I'll just try and it started with me just sort of trying to raise some money for them and sending clothes. And, you know, when it's minus 15 degrees and you're out there in virtually no clothes, you know, giving it started at that. And then I soon realized at my dinner table with all these diplomats, I couldn't make any difference telling them this was happening. And it was politically incorrect. I could see these Australian headlines, you know, diplomat sent home because wife is accusing government of, you know, like I couldn't speak. And that frustrated me as a speaker, you know, someone who talks. And I couldn't do the language anyway. So it was just really frustrating for me. So I thought, I know they can't not hear my stories. So I'm going to volunteer there. So I literally went down to this place and said, I want to volunteer here. I'll never forget the first day I sat on a lounge with a prostitute next to me going, oh, my gosh, I'm a North Shore Sydney girl and I'm sitting next to a prostitute. What do you talk about? I was terrified. But, of course, over 4 years I soon learned that they're actually really, really broken, just really sad on the inside, trying to make the best of their lives. You're watching young, beautiful girls, you know, stunning when they arrive, within 2 years looking like they're 40 years old, and the drugs that the fastest way to control somebody is through heroin, the needles that they needed, and then they get to the point where they need, like the Stockholm syndrome, they need their trafficker because they need their next hit. And so it was very sad, and I'd spend many a morning just helping wash the blood off women who'd been beaten all night and abused all night, getting them ready.
Oh, my God.
Painting their nails. And, you know, I think you'll talk to any founder of any charity and they've all got a story like that. That I've got worse stories and I'm not sure. I don't even in my own mind go back to some of the stories. That's just a very brief understanding of why my life changed. And so when I came back to Australia and someone said to me, don't waste your experience there, try and help people here, I was like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? And they said, no, there's slavery happening in Australia. So I thought, well, now it's game on. I can talk. I can lobby. I can do stuff.
Nothing's stopping me here.
Yeah, this is because I really thought I knew I couldn't go back to corporate world and business. Well, I am back in business world. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I knew I couldn't go back to that. I just couldn't deal with the fact that women could not get out of a situation. And then I was in a position, I thought, of power, and I still couldn't do anything about it for political reasons. And the whole thing was just catalytic for me. I was just like, this is all wrong. There's got to be a way to be a voice for these women, and there's got to be a way to change the system. The system's so broken. So I spent a year researching. I volunteered in the Salvation Army Safe House for Trafficked Women, which was just 10 beds in the city. They've now moved out west. But I sort of went there, and I started to realise that it is different in Australia. I probably spent 6 or 8 months with them. I started to learn that in Australia we have a system, and it's rigid, and I'm not a caseworker, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a social worker, and I'm like, oh my gosh, am I ever going to be able to work in this area, because we've got rules and laws and stuff. So I was trying to work out what I could do with my experience, and it soon became apparent that a lot of these ones that have been there a long time waiting for their court case to come up had nothing to do. And so as the court case loomed, the facing the perpetrator, what they'd been through, just became bigger and bigger and more fearful for them. And so I started taking them on outings just to the beach. I started helping them look for jobs. I found that those that got a job, say at McDonald's, which was as high as I aimed, couldn't keep the job because they'd end up in trauma and triggering. And so I soon realised that they needed actually help in how to live in the Australian community. Started with my own knowledge, just training them and teaching them, but I also know what it was like being in another country and with another language on how to do things, what it takes to even get on a bus in another country, or, you know, not go to self-serve, ask for something and ask for the change, you know, to buy and to shop. So I just applied all the things that I learned in Germany being another country to Australia. Started roping my friends in, fundraising. We'd sell our secondhand clothes at Glebe Markets to make some money so that we could afford to take them to the beach or take them to the zoo and teach them about our animals. And, you know, so I only started with 3 or 4 women from that safe house. And then eventually we realized that I couldn't keep bringing volunteers into the safe house. It was no longer a safe house, and I had to step out on my own. So that was another huge decision for me, because I've never run a charity before. I hate fundraising. asking for money is a hard thing to do. And I just had to try and work out what I, you know, how to set up a school. So it was really with the strength of the modern slavery community, like Fuzz and Carolyn Kiddo and some of the people in that sort of sector that really sort of said to me, you can do this, you can do this.
So they're people within modern slavery organisations, actually.
Yeah,
tackling.
They lobby, yes. And I met a lot of people through that network, through the Be Slave. It used to stop the traffic. It's now Be Slavery Free. But I, you know, met a lot of people through that network. Most of them are lobbying or fundraising for overseas work. The Red Cross, Salvation Army, and the Freedom Hub really are the few that really work specifically with Australian victims. But I got a lot of confidence from them, and I learned a lot about what was happening. People were doing overseas, like Hagar, and there's a lot of overseas organisations that run businesses and run schools, and you know, Outland Denim. There's a lot of people that do stuff. So I really spent a year researching and working up the courage to do it. So it was really 2013 that I started to run my own classes independently outside of the safe house. And then once I did that, I could get more referrals. I could get referrals from the Red Cross and from other agencies. So it rapidly grew until it reached the point where I realised I couldn't just keep selling clothes at Glebe Market on a Saturday. We needed to get some serious funding. And for me, being in business, you're not going to get many questions in because I'm on a roll now.
Go, you just keep going.
But because I'm an ex-businesswoman, I thought there's got to be a way that I can do business. I could run a cafe, or I could run something that could help fund this, rather than, because that's my skill set. And I was getting more and more volunteers that were sort of like teachers and people that knew about trauma. And I just thought there's got to be a way I can do this. So I put together a business plan for a cafe, stupidly thinking that cafe would be the easiest option. I'm still, our cafe's still struggling to make profit. But
and this is when? When's this?
This is in 2013.
Yeah.
And I was researching, and I was also then towards the end, early 2013, 2012 and 13, I was really in no man's land. But I started looking for funding. I put the business plan together. I started looking for funding. I hired a Hoyts Theatre and hired a film called Freedom. And it's the story of the transatlantic slave trade and comparing it to some slavery in America put together by quite a few people. But Peter Cousins, who was Australia's Phantom of the Opera, I'm a bit of a fangirl, he produced it, put it together. And I asked him if he'd come and speak at it and as to what motivated him to do that. And I sold tickets for like $75 that people paid for to meet him and learn about what I wanted to do. And I was really just pitching the idea of finding a place that we could run a school at rather than me trying to run it in coffee shops and at beaches and stuff. That was the beginning because someone in that audience had some serious funding or knew someone with some serious funding who then had their secretary ring me the next day and say, have you ever thought about running a cafe to fundraise for what you're doing? And I'm like, well, it just so happens I have a business plan here. Yes, I have thought about that.
Wow.
Yes. So it's
synchronicity.
Absolutely, absolutely incredible timing. And I saw the building, it's the building we're in now, and went, oh, there's, you know, that's in the back street. There's no way we'll sell much coffee there. And I said, well, there's no way it'll be profitable. And they said, well, what if we helped with the rent? And at the time, they covered the rent. So I'm like, I'm listening, I'm doing. And so, you know, I went. And they still seriously contribute towards the rent. It's gone up a lot over the 10 years. And so we're probably almost 50-50, or maybe they're still paying a bit more. But it's been the main reason I've stayed where we are. What's turned out to be not the greatest cafe, it's turned out to be a great events venue because it's beautiful. It's a big warehouse. It's 100 years old with original pebble, hand crushed pebble floors from the Murrumbidgee, and it's got the big beams, and brides love hanging plants from it, and corporates love hiring it. I even had Facebook, the New York team, come out from America and hire it. And I'm like, why aren't you on Sydney Harbour? You're in the back streets of Waterloo. You know?
I'm not surprised. Can I just say, this is how I discovered you, Sally, and I can't believe that I didn't know of you before then. And it was a fair trade event. I'd been asked to facilitate a panel, and it was at your venue at the Freedom Hub. And I walked in, and it is beautiful. Yes. It is absolutely stunning. So I can understand why Facebook would choose it. I can understand why you get weddings there. It's beautiful. It's stunning. So to Sydney listeners or anyone visiting Sydney, if you get a chance, pop over. We'll include a link to the Freedom Hub in the notes.
Yeah, so that was the beginning, really, and 100% of the profits support the survivors I had. But, of course, now we're scaling so much. We have so many survivors in so much need. So, really, you can never take the retail out of the retailer. My corporate world was national procurement for Myers Australia. So added in some online because I grew up in the era when Ethiopia and starving children, eat all your vegetables on your plate, all this because there's people starving in Africa, you know, that sort of mentality. And I knew that would never happen. I always hated seeing on television, you know, the big stomachs and the flies up their nose. And I just felt so, you know, as a teenager, I just didn't feel empowered in any way to be able to give. I couldn't, but I couldn't do anything about it. So I just really had this thing that I couldn't run a charity that didn't give an opportunity for everybody to do something about it. Right. So I thought, if I've got an online retail store, someone in Broken Hill at Mother's Day can buy a candle that talks about, you know, freedom and slavery, and know that 100% of the profits are helping people. So if they're in Sydney, they can have a cup of coffee. Sure, that was great. But it was so localized. I thought, we've got to come up with a way that everybody can do something. So besides donate, of course, we've got a donut button like every charity. But I really wanted people to be able to realign their spending. You're already buying a Mother's Day gift. Why don't you get a gift from our store? You're already buying, you know, coffee to take home for your machine. Why don't you buy our coffee online? We've even got a beautiful ballerina artwork sketched and designed by one of our survivors who did one of our art therapy classes, and it's beautiful. And so there's gift ideas there. So that's why I expanded into that. And so the business became the cafe, the event space, very local, and then the retail. By the time COVID, we really got to the point where we were 60% self-funded. And so I never drove the charity, you know, donor thing. I probably have 4 or 5 people make a donation once a month. I love those people. I can see why charities do that, because you've got an ongoing budget, you know, that's coming in. And COVID's taught me I need to start doing more of that. And I hadn't really ever applied for grants. And as you know, no one knew he existed, because I was doing no marketing, because every time you get money, you go, oh, my gosh, I really have got the survivor that needs this. And so word of mouth was how we've really grown. Everything changed, as you know, with COVID. And marketing had to become a priority so that people knew we existed. I had to come up with alternative ways of funding, because hospitality, all the staff went home to their countries. We have no chef. We had no... We couldn't get staff, and my main managers my main manager of the cafe on pretty big money was having to be a barista to people that would stand at the door and go one coffee with a mask on, and it would be lucky to sell 20 coffees in a day. So it was not going to fund and help my survivors. So that's when I realised the Modern Slavery Act, which is another whole topic, had come out. We'd been part of the lobbying. I'd always been engaged in the... You know, I'm very networked with the community of anti-slavery organisations in Australia. And we lobbied very well. We work very well together in lobbying situations. And so we'd literally spent the last 10 years, or up to 2018, it's probably the 6 years leading up to COVID, really fighting for this act to come in. So we had a law against slavery, and we had engaged corporates and businesses to think about their supply chains. So I'd been part of all that, but I had never really realised that all my speaking at some of these big consulting agencies, I thought I was just raising awareness. It was all about my heart. And then I realised that they were actually selling my IP or my experience to people. I thought, here's a way I could help fund what we do. So I literally started charging for, which was just not something I'd ever thought to do before. So to this day right now, our ethical business consulting, still word of mouth, but we are very, very busy. We've probably got 20 large corporates now, all over 100 million that we're just working with, helping them with their response to slavery, training all their employees on understanding slavery, having survivor voice and advice in what works in their policies and what doesn't work. So we've got, not only have we got all the survivor experience in their response and their remediation and the way they manage their response to slavery legally, I've got years of procurement experience in dealing with suppliers and how to work with them to do their due diligence and how to manage suppliers and procurement. So that combination has turned out to be a massive win for us, and without question, it's our future. Most of the big corporates went with their law firms and their consultancies to start with, but because the Modern Slavery Act requires yearly demonstration of measurement and improvement on your risk, the only way to do that is with an organisation like ourselves. There's others, but ours is very practical. They're having to talk, oh gosh, what do we do? How do we actually do that? What if we find someone in a factory? You know, we're networked with NGOs all over the world, because I'm on the Commonwealth Government's Sustainable Development Goal 8.7 Management Committee. So we're networked all over the world. We've got people and within modern slavery, we're networked. So that was a really big pivot for us during COVID, and it will never change. It's going to become very strongly part of our new model.
Is that huge for you now?
For me, I've had to pull myself out of the business to work on this. Yes.
Yeah, I imagine this is just going to boom.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm not the legal expert. Fortunately, my daughter with human rights, she's on that team. And I have a guy who was a consultant for one of those big consultancies. So he understands the legalities of of human rights in business and all that. So as a team, and I've got another girl on our team who has actually worked and lived in Myanmar, has been into Chinese factories, can identify people that are in slavery because they're very good at making like their factories look right for the inspectors. And so, you know, we've got a really great practical team between us in each area, and governance as well. We've got people that are, my daughter particularly has spent the last 3 years making board packs, taking minutes and being part of governance structures. So, and on our board, we've got people that are in obviously that have been in slavery organisations like International Justice Mission. We've got people who have been HR and worker rights and worker voice experience and governance and project planning. So we've really got a great team for working with those sort of corporates, which is great because I thought it would always just be grassroots me training. My heart is to train all businesses. I don't think you should be over 100 million to do this. So we definitely structure our pricing so that if you're just a little startup business, we can help with that.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square meter of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square meters by 2025. So can you talk a little bit about the Modern Slavery Act, just for those who don't know?
Yes, the Modern Slavery Act requires any large business over $100 million in consolidated revenue. That should be coming down to $50 million this year. That's before Parliament right now. We lobbied hard for that because that's the standard across the world. So they must submit a statement every year that assesses their risk of slavery. So they're not going, oh, gosh, we have found a slave. They're saying in these areas of our business, we have discovered that we are at risk of slavery. And that risk is broken down into, are you causing the slavery, which very few people confess to that, but some do and they get awards for it, like the chocolate company overseas. But you're causing slavery, are you linked to slavery or are you contributing? So it's quite involved, but there are 7 mandatory requirements within the Act. And so we're particularly good at helping them with the linking to slavery and that area. We're very good. And part of it then is you've got to measure. You've got to not only state those areas, but then you need to measure how are you assessing that and how are you improving and demonstrate that. You have to demonstrate, so you have an action plan on what you're going to do to reduce your areas of high risk. And that needs to be showing improvement every year. And then there needs to be remediation processes. So if you've just, how can you make good on any areas that you feel that you may have been linked to or causing slavery? And of course, that's where the Freedom Hub excels because there's very few people that can help businesses with remediation. And we train because the other part of their, you know, you can't just say the board of directors and the CEOs are responsible for supply chain, all the staff that, you know, someone's left work or leaving and it's their birthday and they're running out and buying some chocolate using the company card. They're instantly breaching their law if they're spending it on slavery chocolate. So how are you making sure to the company, how are they making sure that it's woven throughout the whole company? And it's not a tick box compliance, we must. It's a, oh my gosh, I really want to do this. So that's our, the Freedom Hub's point of difference. Ours is much more, yes, it's, we do train and teach about risk, we help with risk and we help assess it and everything, but it's not a, you know, if you don't do this, you're no longer going to be our supplier. It's how can we work with those suppliers to help them improve, because it's not going to solve the problem if we shut down factories or just go somewhere else. We've actually got to improve human rights. So we will work with companies on their relationship with their supply chain, right down to the raw materials if need be. And we will work with them right down to the receptionist or the sales rep that's running around filling up his car with fuel we will help industry specific every company as much as we can. So so that's by law. But of course, I want everyone to be able to do this. So you can submit a voluntary statement, as have we do. And as a lot of all our suppliers do, because I want them to, and we help them write theirs. But I also train, we also run training Zooms that for people that want to get the basics so that they can do it themselves. They don't have to hire lawyers and stuff. They can actually do their own risk assessment and put in their own voluntary statement. The advantage for that is that they can actually demonstrate to the world that they care. And that whole love question you talked about, care about human rights, they care about people and the planet. It's usually people that care about both that do this. Because it's a public register. Anyone can jump onto the government's register and see who's submitted a statement. So it's sort of like a massively great place to go for your next supplier of anything. You can sort by category. You know, you can go by hospitality if I'm looking for a caterer. You can go
Wow.
Yeah. So the more people that are on that, the more, I mean, it could be a lot better register. Of course, we would love, I would love to see that register become like a shopping, you know, become a search by right down to product, and it could be used hugely. And that's another thing that in my consultations with government, I keep saying, why we've got all this data and all this material on your site, let's use it for good. But at this stage, it's still very much, you've got to know the holding company because it's put in by the holding company. If it's a small business, it's easy. You know, you can just Google the name, you know, Wags and Tags or whatever and get it and find it. But if it's owned by a, you know, so it's all by the top who owns the company. So they're all in there. So it's just it helps small businesses be able to say to their customers that we've chosen to do this. Research shows that customers care about this now. 78% of something would change their shopping if they knew that it's ethical and it's sustainable. Yep. And it's, you know, so it's great for small business. But it also means particularly that middle tier that supply the corporates, they're ahead of their competition. So if the corporates are working with their, say, their main, you know, whoever, a particular company, I'll just pick coffee because I'm in a cafe and I'm on a podcast and can't think, but just say we're re-looking at our coffee and they're trying to work because we do encourage them to work with the companies they've already got because we want them to improve. But if they're refusing and they're not budging and so their company's now liable, it's a legal obligation. They've now got to look to another supplier. Well, wouldn't it be obvious to them to look for one that's already put in a statement, whether they've had to or not? There's a company that's already done the due diligence on slavery risk.
Absolutely.
Of course they'll pick them. So it's a benefit marketing-wise. If you want to scale up and you want to supply the corporates, it's a really huge benefit to actually make sure that you have done your due diligence on risk of slavery. And it's just the risk. It's nothing to be scared of. It's just, these are the areas I'm high risk. The Freedom Hub will always be high risk because we've got coffee. And we've got, you know, tea. Tea's super high. Most tea's got slavery in it. So, you know, we're the Freedom Hub. We are high risk. So and we name the areas that we're high risk. Yes, there's low risk areas. And yes, we do all our due diligence. And then there's a whole lot within the risk analysis. You can actually, these are the high risk, but here's the things that I'm doing, the controls that I've got in place to reduce that risk, which means then my residual risk is low. So the Freedom Hub's residual risk is actually low overall. But the whole idea of the Act is to be able to explain where your areas of high risk are and whether you're.
So interesting. And for me, it feels so empowering, right?
Yes.
So for a business, whether you're a large business, medium, small, whatever, it's this idea of, well, it's not just about giving back. As a business, there are so many levers to actually create positive impact, reduce negative impact, create positive impact. And this is such an important one that everybody could do something about.
Everybody can, yes. Unfortunately, time is money and everyone's pushed for time right now and it does take time. But there's no, particularly for voluntary, there's no, you must get this done within a month. You know, you can have a 20-year plan. You can have this year, we're just going to put out questionnaires to our suppliers. Next year, we're going to actually start to ask them if they'll work with us on improving some of their areas of risk. The year after, we're going to, you know, like you can make it a slow process. Corporates can't. I mean, they can, but we don't like that.
Yeah.
Because we want to solve a world problem here. And they big impact. You know, most, the other interesting statistic that gets me really excited, as in we can do something, is that 75% of the global slavery in the world is in Asia Pacific.
Mm.
That's Australia's shopping ground. for our government, for our businesses, for our consumers. We Australians can dramatically impact global slavery just through supply chains and consumer choice, conscious buying.
Absolutely.
And who we partner with. Yep. Yep. So it's an exciting area. So that's been a really advantageous pivot for us. And why not be in that space? Because, you know, all the beautiful thing for the corporates is that they're also having massive social impact results, not just by doing the slavery thing overseas, but the paying of us, which we don't charge the price of Deloitte and Ernst & Young, I can tell you that now, but we're charging a fair amount because it's that's our IP and that's what we know and that's what we can do, but that helps survivors.
Yeah.
So that they actually know that they're directly impacting the issue within our own country, and they can have survivors help them with their policies and with, you know, because we've got a survivor advisory board. These are people that want to make a difference but don't want to be public, and there's a lot that don't want to be public. And they can also employ survivors, which is my
so favorite. Powerful, Sally. It's so, yeah. I love what you're doing. Can you share with our listeners a bit about, you know, how you're helping survivors within the Freedom Hub?
Yes. So over the years, it's really developed into sort of five pillars, actually, of a survivor. It could be a survivor journey, but sometimes survivors come in later in the journey because they've actually got great English and they've had limited trauma. So we may put them straight into our employment pathway. So the pillars are really the onboarding process, which is the whole concept around making them feel safe before they have to do any major decisions in their life. So it's really establishing their safety, making them feel that they're safe, that they're trusted, that all their immediate wellness needs, physical needs, everything's taken care of, because they're the things you worry about the most. Where am I going to get my meal tomorrow? Where am I going to be found by my perpetrator? You know, what am I going to do with my children? What clothes am I going to wear? You know, like just those things, that's that whole, and some people sit in that pillar for a while because they just can't think past anything past that. And it can take us a while to get housing or to get them, you know, that sort of thing. So that's the onboarding pillar. The next is the rebuild stage, which is really, and this is the stage that people can be fully in or they can be part in, but it's really the, how do I live in Australia freely? How do I know I'm not going to walk out the door and my perpetrator's there? What's safe, you know, and that's everything from, you know, just your cybersecurity to living in my community. How do I get a bus? Where's the local Centrelink office? How do I join a library? What's, you know, wherever they live, it's my community. How do I live all the resources and the different free services and the amazing things that are out there for them to tap into, and learning about, you know, the animals on our money, the zoo, what our creatures are, what's that cacking noise, it's a kookaburra, you know, like just all the really basic living in Australian culture stuff, living in your own community, living with learning Australian slang even, you know, like just a lot of fun and learning. Also, we weave in like mental health and trauma stuff in there, but we do that very carefully, that it's not a you need to learn how to shower again because you smell. Honestly, you know yourself, if you've been sick or depressed, you can spend a week in bed and not wash your hair or clean yourself, right? If you've had years of that, you can forget, or it doesn't, you know, so we build in, you know, hygiene and health and wellness and all this into fun workshops and classes. Let's do your makeup and talk about skincare, and let's get a hairdresser in to talk to you about, you know, your style that might suit your face, you know, and they laugh and giggle and stuff, but inwoven in that will be the importance of shampooing your hair and how to care for it, and deodorant and stuff. We even weave in, particularly for potentially our Muslim community, but you know, a tampon, the sex stuff, you know, tampons are going to break your virginity and you can swim in Australia, and you know, like just we weave it in very beautifully so that they don't feel they're being told how to do stuff. And it also, that it becomes, when I say the classes be two or three people, like we're not talking a class like TAFE of 30 people, because there's no feeling of safe and there's no sharing. So we keep them small and we do keep it to their level of English. So we'd gather two or three that are about the same level of English, And then we'd have another group that are perhaps a higher level of English or whatever. And in there is also English conversation, picking subjects. So there's a lot in that sort of rebuild stage. Eventually they get to the point where they want to start, and this is for us a big measure of success, when they start to go, I'd really like to try and get a job. Right? You remember, they've come out of a job that they've been abused in. It's a big step to want to work. And, there are a lot of people out there that go, oh, we've got to get them a job, it's going to solve all their problems. No, it's not. Because if they go straight into this stage, having not done the building blocks of feeling safe, learning about our community, they fall over very quickly in the workplace. So if they've hardly been in slavery and they've got virtually no trauma and they've got really strong English, so they may have been a school teacher in their home country, they've come here to improve that, or, and they've got out of the situation really quickly because they've realized that, they could be straight into this, but they've still got to do some of that. We still do that foundation, join the cosmetic or the skincare workshop, join the trauma-informed art class, we can have people, you don't have to do all these topics to move into the next pillar, right? So they can be spread across. But we work with them on a success plan. What is their idea of success, not ours? So someone who's got pidgin English from Papua New Guinea, success to them could be working in McDonald's. An Iranian lady who is a lawyer in her own country, success will never be anything less in our country. So it'll take her a lot longer to get there in our country. But, so we let them write their success plan. And that is the thing that we keep in front of them when they're having bad times and they slip backwards. It's not you need to do this to hold your job or get a job. It's remember your success, remember your dreams. This is why it's called the Freedom Hub, because it's about their future. The caseworkers, the police, the doctors, everybody, the psychs are all talking about what happened to them as if that's their identity. We're like, yes, that happened to you, but what can we do to help you rebuild and focus on your future and your freedom?
Wow.
Because freedom is way more than having a man locked up in jail or a person locked up in jail for what they did to you. It's your freedom in here.
Yes, yes.
And so, that's our whole focus, is their future and what we can do to help them be strong and independent. For us, the goal is that they come out of our school or they finish our program. Not that it's a program, because it can go on for 10 years for one person, it can go on for 6 months for another. But they reach the success plan or what their idea of success, but they are living independently, they're holding down a job, so they have successful independent lives. That is our goal for each one. And that is tailored to what they see as success. So that thrive pillar is the pillar that we feel is really in social enterprise world, we'd call what we're a wise social enterprise, whereas work integrated social enterprise. So that thrive pillar is training them for a work placement. The success pillar is when they're in a job. So those two pillars can stand independently for funding, which is what I've had to learn over the last since COVID, applying for grants. This is where people, grant writers, they want to see people employed, vulnerable people that don't fit in our normal education. So that is where we're getting a lot of leverage post-COVID now, because people want to invest in that. And so we're really scaling that now. And it's also becoming our future. And corporates tie well into that, because they can be paying for them to do a computer course to be ready to work in their admin office. Or so anyone that says they want to join, any corporates or businesses that want to join our employment pathway program, they're actually sponsoring and helping the survivor get ready for that role.
Mm.
So it's becoming a great need for us to find employers and people that want to be part of this employment program. And the employment program set up so that the survivor has a 2 to 4 week paid, because they have to be paid. You can't rescue them from not being paid and put them in a job where they're not paid. But they go in with a work experience mentality. They're told it's a work experience. That's for good reason. We don't want them to feel shame or failure if that doesn't work.
Yep.
It could not work from their path, but also businesses can go, actually, they've got big hearts, but maybe this is not for us right now. So it's an out for everybody. It means they've ended up with some confidence because they've been positioned in a role that we've selected a safe organisation. We've prepared them for that role. They walk out feeling great after that month, and they have an Australian reference. If the employer says, actually, this is working really well. We love it. We'd like to employ them. We have like a 6-month window where we work together. So that means that there is a person identified within the organization that's their safe person, who knows that they've come from the Freedom Hub, because we don't want them going in there and everybody knows their story. And everyone will tippy-toe around them, and they'll never have success in life if that's the case. So they are placed into that employment with that company, where, of course, the heads have to know because they're the decision makers, but they have to sign their life away on confidentiality. But we find a safe person within that company that also knows, and we train that safe person to be able to notice triggers, traumas, indicators that maybe that they've slipped back, because they will, as the court cases get closer, they, you know, or if they're worried or stressed about something, they can stop eating. They will never, not never, they rarely tell you, because they don't, the shame, but also the fear that they might lose the job or whatever. So we train that person, and that person would talk to us if they think there's something not right, or they're turning up late. Or if they're brave enough and they do have a serious trigger, it could be just an aftershave or a song that's played, they've got someone they know they can go to and say, I have to go home, or I've got a migraine, or whatever their reason is, that they're not going to lose the job. And that person will come to us. We then immediately get our counsellors, or their safe, their past teachers, or whoever is, you know, they're connected to within our organization, straight onto it. So they're not losing the job, but they've given a bit of grace. So that sort of goes on for 6 months while we work together to make sure. And also, sometimes employers have rung us and said, love them, love everything, but they're really a bit slow in this area. We'll just bring in extra tutoring and tutor and help them speed up. A really simple example.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So a really simple example was a survivor that had limited English, and she didn't want a big career type job or anything in a corporate, but was happy to work in a factory, just a packing, you know. And there were certain products that she just kept messing up or was really slow in the packing. And, you know, these people, you know, you've got to get them to Australia Post real fast and get it delivered, because everyone wants their delivery within 12 hours. And it turned out, once we sat down and talked to her, that she didn't understand it was a vegan product, Choc MT was chocolate mint, you know, like she just didn't understand the abbreviations on the shelves. So we simply got the company to give us a copy of all the shelf labeling, and it was like playing Snap just for half an hour a week. We'd just throw it down.
Sometimes it's just the simple things,
as
right?
Simple as that. And she would, in the past, she'd probably have not got the job or lost the job pretty quickly, because she was packing. But we just literally sped her up, sped read. What's this? What's this? What's this? And she got faster and faster. We'd clock it, and we just made it fun.
I love that.
Yeah. And before you know it, she's the fastest one on the thing, you know. So it's that's little things. So we just look for ways that we can really make them successful and help them with success in life. So so that's an example of how our employment program works. And then the alumni program is the last pillar, and they're the people that have got that job, they're happy in life, they're doing everything really well, but we've been their family for however long. They've got peers, they've got people in our, so we just invite them along to our socials. We're going to the beach this weekend, or it's Australia Day, we're going to the thong throwing at Manly, or, you know. So they get invited to all that stuff, which means we've got great peer support for the people who are still just in that rebuild stage. They're seeing people who have made it through, and, you know, that's just great both ways. It helps them continue to socialize, be with people that are in the situation they were in. It helps them give back. It helps the people that are in the rebuild feel stronger, because they've got people there that they can see as successful and working, they can ask questions from. We also check in with them quarterly, just mental health questions, you know, to help them there. But things like tax time, they need help with their tax. The fridge breaks, who do I ring? You know, we just get random, you know, I've been to the doctors and I've been to the dentist and need root canal therapy. I've got no money. What do I do? You know, just random things that come in. So we never offboard people. We're there for life. We're there for their lifetime. And we have had women leave and we haven't heard from them for 3 or 4 years. And then suddenly they've met a man and in a great healthy relationship and had babies. We've now got, I don't know, somewhere between 8 and 10 babies. In that alumni stream, they're now meeting. We've set it up so they go to each other's house with their kids and have a little mother's group. We got midwives from during COVID. We had to get midwives from St. George that we trained, and we sat in and over Zoom. We taught them how to breastfeed and how to do stuff. Like, it's just quite funny. Oh my gosh!
Can I just say I'm blown away. I just think, you know, you've developed something that is so human centered, that really starts with empathy.
Yes,
you know. Understanding, and just, oh, what an incredible journey. Like, I love it when you say you never offboard people. It's remarkable what you've achieved. And the other thing that's really remarkable to me, and just it, like, you've started this, it's a purpose-driven organization, right? Oh. You started it. Purpose is at the center of everything you do. And, you know, it's, I say on your website, creating a world of freedom by ending modern slavery. But the remarkable thing is, and it's actually not remarkable because this is what purpose does, is all the pieces that come together to do that. So you've got your cafe, you've got the event space, you've got the retail operation. Now, that's all business to consumer, right? And then you've got a B2B side. So, you know, you're managing B2C and B2B at the same time, and a nonprofit organization.
Yes.
It's all of everything all in one. Everything everywhere all at once, yes. As the film goes.
Yes, exactly. There are days I feel that. we've got a fabulous team, though. Like, just they are purpose, you know, themselves. They, you know, and that's what we're struggling with now, of course, is volunteers that have that. Like, people are a bit more choosy on volunteering their time right now since COVID. We used to have a waiting list, you know, and we used to have the bar here, you know, we really scream. Now we're almost begging people I'm still very determined to find people that's.
So let's. I'm conscious that we're running out of time, and there's some questions I want to put to you. First one is, what's your vision of success? Like 5 years from now.
5 years from now.
If your wildest dreams could come true, what does the Freedom Hub look like?
It's easy for me to answer, only because we're at 10 years and I'm now looking at the next 10 years and also looking at my age. So I've really had to sit down and envision the next 10 years. And while it's not completely consolidated, our board are looking at it. I've got whiteboards in front of them next Monday night at our meeting. But I'm my vision. So it's not necessarily the Freedom Hubs just yet, but I am seeing that this corporate, the business, the council and the community are all engaged in a Freedom Hub locally. So we could cookie cutter across the nation. But let's start with Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne and Perth and South Australia, you know, Adelaide. I want to start with the cities. But this has all come about because we need to move our survivor school to Parramatta, because they're not travelling into the city anymore. A lot of the caseworkers that were in the city are now doing stuff online thanks to COVID. The world's changed since COVID. Most of our survivors in Sydney are out west. We need to move our location. But in doing that, I've got no connections in businesses there. I've got limited businesses in Parramatta, limited. We already have community services that, like domestic violence centres and youth centres and people that refer people that have come across their doorway that's been in slavery. We're already getting plenty of referrals like this. We've got support from the community services. But we need businesses out there now. And then the council are really behind seeing their local businesses engage in social impact. So the council are talking to us. So I've got this whole new model that I think Parramatta will be the test case for it. But I can so see it. As social entrepreneurs, we can. I can just see every part of this working. I can't see that. I'm really struggling to find what's not going to work around it. So then within that district, we will have a hub and a school. So it's no longer coffee shop in Sydney Central. We'll keep all that. We need that's head office, and that's people know that's headquarters. But we can actually set up hubs like this in each town and city.
You say you need businesses, what do you need from businesses?
So from businesses, I want businesses that want to have social impact in the area of helping humans, of modern day slavery particularly. Those businesses, we're looking for businesses that will employ. We're looking for businesses that might provide volunteers or be engaged in helping us rebuild these lives. Many businesses want to fund. What I love about, but I love the fact that by employing and by training or volunteering, it's another way to give back and help this vision that we have that's not giving money. Don't get me wrong, always need money, but it is just another way. It's another entry for many businesses. And huge corporates can do both. They've got foundations and they do. But what I love is, say, a big foundation like Westpac Foundation, who have been a great support to us for years, they actually have a branch and actually a big major office in that Parramatta region. I was actually talking to the Perth Westpac coordinator about this vision in Perth, you know, so they've got, and it helps them with their employees engaged on a grassroots and ground level. It's not the foundation doing this. This is that branch. Our local branch is helping the Freedom Hub with this, and this. And that can be every bank. It can be every corporate. It could be, you know, so it helps the companies really, you know, have volunteer days and work with that particular hub. So I think that's what I really need from corporates. And then small businesses, same deal. A lot of our survivors are not ready for a corporate role or being in a big corporate. You know, they're happy to pick and pack in someone's, you know, small startup in the lounge room. You know, like, obviously we screen everything. We don't just grab any, you know. So for me, I think in 5 years' time, I would 100% like to see every major city. 5 years, I think that's doable. At least the East Coast. It's definitely, we're already in Brisbane. Brisbane's going to be easy. So having Melbourne established and Perth established, only because Perth's underway, and then potentially I want to try and work out how I can partner in the smaller, like Tassie, ACT, because we'll see. But it could be regional. This model could be regional towns. It could be, we've got survivors in Tamworth. Let's see what we can do with local businesses and areas and create a Freedom Hub.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Sally, thank you so much for coming and giving your time to share your story and tell us what the Freedom Hub does. I'm absolutely blown away by what you've created. And I hope that from this podcast, you know, some of our listeners will get in touch with you and tell other people about what you're doing, because it's just remarkable and there's opportunity for everybody within there. So thank you. I'm going to hand over to you for any last words and to close us out.
Well, last words would be, everybody can do something about this crime in our country and overseas. Think about what you can do, but also think about what your heart and passion is. If it's another cause, that's fine. But if you think that this is your cause, we would love to hear from you. And you're going to put the links in for people to contact us. Yeah,
I certainly am.
So much for having me. And I love that you have a podcast around this theme.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?